Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we have Jerry Williams. He's a cinematographer and an independent filmmaker. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm really happy to have you here. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you started as a cinematographer?
I actually grew up in Salt Lake City and moved to San Diego when I was, oh gosh, I have to do the math here. I guess I was 21, uh-huh. And I've been here ever since. And I don't know, I've always been interested in the movies. My family had 8mm cameras, and my best friend and I in junior high, we started shooting our own 8mm films. In fact, most of them happened right after we saw 2001, A Space Odyssey. That just kind of inspired us to, you know, get the cameras and see if we could do special effects work. And we did quite a number of those.
Sort of like Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, pretty much. I didn't use much of my family in cast. We did a lot of, what would you call it, spaceships moving and things like that. We slowly put some people in, mostly best friends, and we did it all the way up through high school. And when I went to college, my best friends, him and I, went as a physics majors. We both graduated with physics degrees, but my last year, the math kind of got me, so I got out of physics and started taking some of the filmmaking classes because it was fun.
Yeah.
And then I moved to San Diego in 75 and started taking classes on television production down at Grossmont College and City College. And then eventually when I finished putting my girlfriend through San Diego State, she got her zoology degree, I went back to San Diego State into the film department there. And they hired me to be their film tech all through the 80s. So I spent 9 years there as their film tech. And the last 3 years, I actually got to do some teaching, which I really enjoyed.
Hmm.
And then I left San Diego State and started doing a lot of, low-budget feature films.
Cool.
Only one's been in San Diego. Most of them have been out of Los Angeles. Two have been down in Mexico out of Tijuana. That was interesting.
Yeah, I bet. Did you have a mentor that helped you start your career?
Absolutely. His name is Ralph Woolsey, ASC. ASC stands American Society of Cinematographers. And he retired from the ASC and from Hollywood filmmaking and moved to San Diego and wanted to teach. So they gave him, I think, 3 semesters at San Diego State, and I was basically his right-hand man. And a lot of times we'd be shooting a project that they put, the students were involved with. They had a writing group that wrote the script. They had a set decoration or a set design course that actually built the set. And we got some student actors. And Ralph would all of a sudden take off in the middle of the shoot and turn everything over to me. So it was my job to keep his image and his look going through the rest of the shoot. So that was very educational.
That's interesting. So
yeah.
You were sort of like the got thrown into the boiling water.
Yeah, except it was a student film, so I wouldn't really call it. It was lukewarm water.
Lukewarm, okay.
Yes.
Did you enjoy learning film by doing, or were you more of a classroom type person?
I'm actually more of a learn by doing,
mm-hmm.
And I learned enough that the last 3 years I were there, they were actually letting me teach the advanced filmmaking class laboratories. So
wow.
People would come to me to learn how to use the different cameras, how to do the sound systems, how to do lighting, how to do the editing gear. And I found I learned a lot by teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And except for the politics, I really can't wait to get back into teaching that kind of thing.
Cool.
Yep.
And do you have a classic cinematographer that you look up to?
Oh, I've got a handful, yes. But Gordon Willis, ASC, is probably my favorite. You know, he shot The Godfathers. He shot most of Woody Allen stuff. And he's just, you know, I can watch all of his stuff all day over and over again and just go in and analyze it. Because I find myself looking at it and getting caught up in the story and away from my analysis of it. So I'm going to go back and see how he did that. But
wow.
Romo Zygmunt, Caleb Deschanel, Roger Deakins, they're all cinematographers whose work I follow quite a bit.
And when you're watching a film, is it normal for you to be analyzing instead of enjoying the film?
If I'm not caught up in the story, yes. But if the filmmakers did their job and they're telling a story, I get invested in the story. And I don't go back and, you know, really study the stuff until the second or third look. Like Gravity, I just saw that with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. I got so caught up in the story that even the science part of me wasn't taken aback very much by a lot of the stuff that wasn't quite the way it really is. And I can't wait to go back and see it again and start looking at how they put it together.
I love that with film, though. I think that's what
yes.
I think it's part of being creative that you have to be able to, you know, there has to be able to suspend the audience's belief a little bit in order to be able to create the story. I think that's cool.
Yeah, that's absolutely crucial because otherwise you're just doing, I hate to say this, but it's video masturbation.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing it not for the purpose of the story, but to say, look how nice the image looks and how well the actress looks and things like that. And that isn't telling a story, and it's not going to work as a film.
Well, I think you need to be able to relate to the people. I mean, otherwise you're just looking at pictures, and that's not as exciting as having a heart in a film. I mean, that's something I think some of the young people miss.
Yes, but there is a way of doing that. If you look at a film like Kleana Scotsi, which is, you know, has no speaking parts, but it's all visual, but it's done in such a way that it tells a story and gets you emotionally wrapped up in just the images. So
yes.
There are exceptions to the rule.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and it depends on, because the actress or actor that's in the movie, if they're good, and most actors and actresses that are film actresses, that it's all in their face and in their eyes, yeah, of course, they're going to tear your heart out just by doing the right movement and showing the emotion through their face.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a big difference between getting somebody who's got traditional stage acting and bringing them onto a film set.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to scale their performance down because you can punch in with the camera lens to a close-up of their eyes. And just the way they crinkle their eyes tells volumes, you know, as opposed to them doing the big emotive hand gestures and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's actually easier for a film actress to learn the craft of stage acting than the stage actor sometimes to learn the craft of film acting. I've noticed that with some of them. I mean, they're brilliant stage and film actors like Laurence Olivier and people and Vivian Leigh and people like that. But, I mean, I'm talking about, like, Elizabeth Taylor, she was a child actress, so she was really good at doing all that. But then she was on stage doing Private Lives and Little Foxes, and she was brilliant.
Absolutely. There are people like Elizabeth Taylor and several others, we could go on for an hour just naming actors and actresses, who can just walk into a room and their presence is so great that you just can't help but be drawn to them. And you put them in front of a camera and it just amplifies that.
Yep. Yeah, and yet they can do theater.
Mm-hmm. And there are there are actresses and actors that I would put in front of a camera and sit there and watch them read the phone book,
mm-hmm.
just because they are so captivating as an actor.
Yeah, that's true. They're not that many, but they're still really one I can think of is Pierce Brosnan. You know, he has that ability to draw you in, and when he's just doing an interview, he's just as entertaining as he is when he's doing a movie. There's not that many, though.
Well, I've had a pleasure of working with several of them, so I can't wait to get back and do some of them again.
Cool.
You know, shoot some more films with these people.
What was the first book or movie that captured your imagination? Was it 2001, or was there an earlier film?
There were earlier films that I was always captivated by, but 2001 was the catalyst that literally pulled me into filmmaking. You know, until then, I'd look at the films and say, hey, that's kind of fun, and, you know, I never really did anything with it. But after Tim and I saw 2001 in the theater on the big Cinerama screen, you know, we just had to get home. We had to start flying models from the ceiling in our basement and building moon bases and things like that. We shot a lot of Ray Bradbury stories because Ray Bradbury writes in such a visual way that
yes.
It was very easy to turn his stories into really great little films. I'm kind of wondering if some of those films actually survived. I'm going to have to get hold of Tim and find out. It'd be fun to see him again.
Yeah. He used to paint with his words, even when he was giving a lecture, because I remember he came to my school and he gave us a lecture a couple of times, different subjects, and he was very good at that. And he did it in his books, and he did it in person. He just painted with his words. He was a very
yes.
visual writer.
Yeah, he was great. I actually got to shoot a commercial for the San Diego Comic-Con with him, and we went up to shoot it in his office, but the elevator was broken. So he invited us into his house in Bel Air instead. And being in Ray Bradbury's house, shooting a television commercial with him was just awesome.
Wow. I know he's crazy about dinosaurs. Did he have any models in his home?
Oh, absolutely.
Cool.
His home was a museum. It wasn't the Acker Mansion like Forrest Ackerman had, but he had memorabilia. I remember there was a large painting of the cover of the Illustrated Man book on his wall.
Wow.
And that just, you know, took my eye right to it, and it was really difficult to stop looking at it just to go work and do what I was there to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have been staring at it, too. That was one of his most interesting books.
Yeah, he was great, but The Martian Chronicles made a big impact on me, too. I remember reading that in junior high school and discussing it with my friends and drawing the teachers over to us because we were so passionate about the way we're discussing this book. And I've always wanted to do some Martian Chronicles films, but I've just never done that.
That would
and
be
the one
really
time
cool.
The one time I did have a film that I wanted to shoot that I wrote to Ray Bradbury and asked him if I could get permission to do it. I wasn't able to because he had signed it over to that particular story, Kaleidoscope, over to a cable company that did the Ray Bradbury Theater.
Mm.
So he wasn't able to give me permission to do that, but I did work on a couple other films that people did get permission to shoot.
Really cool. How did you go from a cinematographer to an independent filmmaker?
It's pretty much the same thing for me. When I was at San Diego State, I went on a lot of student films. And I started as just a still photographer, go take pictures of the cast and crew working. And I looked around and saw, you know, a lot of people standing around. And everybody, you know, the script people were standing around, the actors were standing around, the director was standing around, everybody but the cinematographer was standing around. And I said, you know, I think that's the job I want. So I watched a few more student films being done, and then I started shooting the student films. And I just started shooting more and more and more, and pretty soon people were coming to me to shoot their films. And I was using the student films to experiment with different looks, different processes. Like, we shot one film all without the filters you need to go outside to shoot daylight, which tended to oversaturate the greens and make it more jungle-like, you know, really super saturate the greens and whatnot. And then you dial that back in when you, in editing, to where the flesh tones look good. And it was really a cool experience. So I did a lot of that kind of experimenting. And eventually I got so good that the school decided that, you know, I can't really do any more student films. Because everybody was coming to me, and, you know, nobody else who wanted to be a cinematographer was really getting the experience there. Although I did bring a lot of people in with me, and I love teaching. And, you know, I taught, used that as a forum to teach, too. I had a full-on crew. You know, I had a camera operator, I had several assistant camera, had a dolly grip, and they were all learning as I was learning at the same time. And eventually I had people go on to shoot other things like that. So it was very rewarding to me, and I really would like to get back into teaching again.
Cool.
But not the politics.
Yeah, I know.
The politics. Yeah.
There's politics in every business, though, even education, every business. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you begin your relationship with the USA Network and Cinemax?
Actually, I didn't have much of a relationship with USA Network and Cinemax. What happened was I hired onto some films to shoot some films for some people I'd already worked for. And after the film was edited, they took and shopped it around. One of them, actually a handful of them, were all done by the same production company, which was also a low-budget film distributor. So a lot of those got sent out on their own. But eventually they got contacted by USA Network and sold the films to them.
Hmm.
It was pretty much the same with the Cinemax project. I did a film called The Story of Jack and Jill and Jill. And when we edited it, it got out, and they started shopping it at film festivals. And Cinemax picked it up, and they changed the title of the film because we had Dana Plato in it, who was the child star from Different Strokes.
Mm-hmm.
The final film, if you go out and look at it now, is Different Strokes, The Story of Jack and Jill and Jill.
Oh, wow.
Where Dana Plato played one of the Jills. And unfortunately, it was one of her last films before she died. So that's kind of my claim to fame, is I've got a late-night Cinemax cable show that's kind of notorious because True Hollywood Story picked it up and kind of made a big deal out of it, which wasn't really there. And, you know, made it kind of infamous.
That's interesting. Yeah, they do tend to do that. I've watched the new specials, and they love to go with something bad. I mean, even if it's not bad, they like to make it bad.
Yeah, well, it's marketing, the way things were sold. There was one film I did called Getting Lucky, which was a sequel to a film called, Wish Me Luck, which was a sequel to a film I did earlier called Getting Lucky by the same crew. But instead of a high school comedy with nerds, jocks, cheerleaders, and a leprechaun, it was a college comedy with nerds, jocks, cheerleaders, and a genie. And the way they marketed that, I've got three or four different posters from that film, the way they marketed it, so that you get a lot of... It was one called Getting Up, which didn't play up the genie at all. So it was just a college sex comedy kind of thing. So it's really interesting to see what they do, what kind of spin they put on these kind of things.
It's interesting. Yeah, marketing is a weird and wild world, I think.
Yeah, it's something somebody else could do. I have no interest in doing that.
Yeah, me neither. I have to market my book. That's hard enough.
Yeah. Marketing myself as a freelancer is hard enough.
Yeah. Do you have any hobbies, something you like to do in your free time?
I love reading science fiction predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly. And one of the wacky things I do that when people ask me, what's something I don't know about you? I tell them, I want to go to Mars. And one of the things I do is I'm a member of the Mars Society. I was one of the co-founders of the San Diego chapter of the Mars Society. And I'm one of the co-founders of the San Diego Space Society. And one of the things I do, because being a filmmaker, you're not working, a 9-to-5 job every day. You work for 2 or 4 weeks solid, and then you have a big break of time. So what I do is I go out to classrooms and libraries and museums and places like that, and I talk about sending people to Mars. We built a scale model Mars rover on top of a radio-controlled truck chassis, and we have a wireless video camera on there. So I take that into schools, and the kids get to drive a Mars rover. And it's sending a camera to a big projection screen in the room, and they have to drive it by looking at the screen, not by looking at where the rover is in the room. So that's some of the fun stuff I do. We've got gravity bricks that show the different weights. If you weighed 100 pounds on Earth, you'd only weigh 38 pounds on Mars. You'd only weigh 16 pounds on the moon. And the kids get to pick that up and see the difference. And we've got a space suit, a Mars suit, and it's really a blast. I do a lot of, PowerPoint presentations, and I really get a kick out of it.
I was just thinking, I know a lot of girls who would like to be on Mars just for the weight.
I know several of the real scientists that are at the NASA JPL site that work on a day-to-day basis with the rovers. And those are some awesome women. I really like doing that. I like seeing that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing I think that's really cool. And people like Sally Ride is inspirational to bringing more women into the space program.
Absolutely.
The late, great Sally Ride.
Yeah, there are a couple other astronauts here. Sally Ride died a few years ago, unfortunately. Yeah. But Ellen Ochoa is an astronaut who lives in San Diego. There are about 4 or 5 other astronauts who live here. And I get to meet them occasionally because we do events out at the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center. We do stuff at the San Diego Air and Space Museum. And, they're fascinated by what we do. I'm fascinated by what they did. I mean, when I was growing up, I wanted to be an astronaut. But I have asthma, so that didn't, I couldn't do that. So I kind of went sideways and got a degree in nuclear engineering because I was going to do spaceship propulsion at that point. But now here I am in the Mars Society, and they have research sites in the Utah desert and the Canadian Arctic where they actually have a Mars habitat that people get to go and live in for 2 weeks at a time, 4 months at a time. They're actually trying to plan one for an entire year right now up in the Canadian Arctic. But I was there on crew number 2 in the Utah desert, and right now I can't remember what crew they're on. It's 112 or something like that.
Wow.
But I worked mission support for them. I've got pictures of me in their spacesuit, and it's just been phenomenal.
That's cool.
Right now I can't, I'm almost 60, and I can't be one of the people to go to Mars because we're still a ways away from doing that. However, I can inspire some of the kids today to be the ones to actually go and set foot on the surface of Mars. And I tell them when I wrap the class up, if one of you gets to Mars before I do, please send me a postcard.
You have a Mars movie night. Why don't you tell the audience about that?
Oh, that was fun. When we formed the Mars Society to begin in San Diego here, we did a bunch of stuff. We went to Comic-Con. We started out with just dinner meetings where we got to dinner and talk, but then we decided to do something, so we put Comic-Con together and did a panels there. We brought in scientists and whatnot. But then we decided we needed a social night where we can just get together and hang and do something fun. So I have a photo studio in Golden Hill. I've got a 10-foot-wide projection screen, video projector, surround system. So I said, I know, let's start watching Mars movies. So I put Total Recall was the first Mars movie back in November of 2001. And with a few exceptions, we've shown Mars movies once a month, every month since then. And it's kind of weird because I didn't think there were that many Mars movies out there. But I got collecting them. And pretty soon I had 30 or 40 Mars movies, and it kept growing. So one of the things I did is I decided, let's make a website called themarsmovieguide.com. And I did that, and I've got every Mars movie I can track down is in there. And I own quite a number of copies of a lot of them. Probably I'd say 75 or 80% of the Mars movies ever made. I've even got a copy of the very first Mars movie that was done by Thomas Edison's company back in 1910. So it's phenomenal, some of the stuff.
That's cool.
And
that's really
yeah,
cool.
As a result of that, I also kind of inherited a group called the San Diego Vintage Sci-Fi Group, where, again, once a month, we show vintage science fiction films. And so I've got the two as kind of sister organizations, and I open up my studio twice a month for people to come in for free and see the films.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. Really cool.
It's a blast.
We don't have a lot of time. Do you have any new projects coming up? Any films?
New project? Well, I've been sick for the past couple of years, and I'm just getting back on my feet. And I've been using that time to do some writing. I've got two or three scripts. One's called Clementine. One's called Summer of the Mummy. So I'm working on those. I want to direct those films. So I want to kind of move up to from shooting into actual doing the whole project.
Mm-hmm.
But right now the big thing for me is I do a lot of corporate and industrial work. I just need to get my feet back under me there and do a lot of that locally. And then I've also got some plans for doing a handful of short and cheap but powerful internet-style films. You know, so I'm looking for a writer who wants to help me with some of those. I'm looking for a producer. I don't produce very well myself, so if I can find a producing partner, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of stuff I've got in the back of my head that's starting to come out now that I'm healthier and can do that. You know, I'm looking forward to this. I want to go back to being what I was doing before I got sick.
Well, I mean, as you're healthy now, so, I mean, that's good that you're able to start doing things again. I think that's amazing.
Exactly.
I
keep telling my wife I'm a real boy again, so I can go out and do real things that real people do.
Yay! Sadly, we're at the end of our time. I told you it goes quick. live audience to thank you, and I'd like to thank you too.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Next week we're going to have author Gary Silisa. He's going to talk about his book, 10 Little Book Secret Puzzles. Thank you, Jerry. I really appreciate it. It was a really fun half hour.
It is fun. See you at the next convention.
Thank you. Yes, I will. And probably one of your Mars nights.
Great.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.